Okay. Keep those Bibles open at Luke chapter 12. If you haven't got them open, grab them off the person next to you. I was reminded this week of how a lot of people in our community view Christianity and the church. I bumped into a fella who was actually here with us a couple of years ago with his wife and kids. And they're around for a couple of months and then they're off again. And as I started to speak to him a little bit about why he came and then why he left again, it was clear that for him, his view on Christianity in the church was that you come along when you're in a bit of trouble and you need a bit of help and you need a bit of advice to get your life back on track, and then you go on your merry way again. And that was, things are going well for him again. Business has gone well again for him, so he's back on track. People usually, when I bump into them in public and they used to be with us and they're not or whatever, they usually feel like they need to explain to me why they're not around anymore. It's kind of the effect I have on people. You probably get that too, yeah, with your friends who feel they need to explain that. Now, on some level, that's okay. At some level, a lot of Jesus' teachings and what we have together as a church can be really helpful for life. It can be good advice. It can help you get your things back together. But it's ultimately a tragedy to simply view Christianity and the church as that. Something that just helps you get going again in life to get about the real stuff. And I say that because at the very heart of Christianity is a God who comes not to just help us get our lives on track. He comes to save us for all eternity, and that's huge. And so I feel a sense of tragedy when I see people who come close but then miss that. And if you're with us at the moment, there's a whole bunch of different reasons why you can be drawn to come. It is great to have you. More than anything, we don't want you to miss the guts of this, the very core of Christianity, what our God has done. I trust that you will be helped in many ways. But whatever you do, don't miss the big one. Now, I'm concerned about that kind of view of Christianity for a couple of different reasons. And here's another reason. Often Jesus' advice to us about life is at complete odds with what the world would say about how to live life. So if you're just coming along to read the Bible and try and get advice for life, it's going to conflict with what people around you are telling you to do. In fact, sometimes Jesus' advice, when you open up the scriptures, his commands, are actually in exact opposite from what the world would say. The world would say, the community around us would say, live this way. This is what's smart to do with your life. Here's a wise way to live. And then Jesus would just go, no, foolish, dumb. And then Jesus would put out his, here's how to live. Come after me, live this way. And the world goes, foolish, dumb. There's a big contrast when we open up the scriptures and hear what Jesus is saying. And this passage we're looking at this week is one of those passages. It's a passage where Jesus actually tells a story about a man and his retirement plan. And the world around us would look at this man's retirement plan and go, you got it, brother. Smart, wise, you're on the right track. This is a bloke who works hard. He stores up his wealth for himself with the idea of down the track having many years where he takes life easy, eats, drinks, and enjoys life. And the world would encourage us to put in place the kind of retirement plan which builds towards that moment where you really get to live. Jesus tells the story to make the point that is utter foolishness to live like that, right against the advice of the world. But right off the bat, I do want to make this clear. Jesus is not saying that it's foolish to have a retirement plan. But he is saying that there's a certain type of retirement plan that is utterly foolish and completely inadequate when you consider what life is really all about. Jesus, I think, would go so far as to say, right throughout the rest of this teaching, to say, get a real retirement plan. Get one where you actually really do store up wealth, real wealth, that's going to be permanently with you for all eternity. And the funny thing about living in a way with that kind of a retirement plan, it means that you are going to find yourself leaning towards doing the kind of crazy things like selling your possessions and giving your money away. Now, that's just weird. Are you ready for that tonight? Are you ready to wrestle with this? Now, I know some of you have already been in this passage all week in your growth groups and you've been throwing it around. I've heard from some of you how that's gone, and I'm always just really impressed with how well you wrestle with the scriptures and we work hard to understand what Jesus has for us here. Let me have a crack at doing that tonight. Let's look at the situation Jesus is in. Pick it up there in verse 13. Jesus is speaking, the crowd is there again, but his teaching seems to be a bit interrupted by a fellow who comes to him with a request. Verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." So some bloke in the crowd interrupts because he's got some kind of dispute going on with his brother about who gets the inheritance. Now, these kind of disputes happen. And in this day, what you would do if you had a dispute is you would find a rabbi, a recognized rabbi in the place where you lived, and that rabbi would make some kind of jurisdictional decision to help you, and what they say would be final. So this bloke's just coming to Jesus with that in mind, really. But Jesus is not really interested in playing those kind of games. Verse 14, Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter between you?" So Jesus, although he could have, he refuses to get involved. He's not interested in getting involved in these things. But what he does do is he takes the opportunity to address an issue that he has spotted in the man's heart. He spots an attitude in this bloke's heart that is far more concerning than simply whether you get half the inheritance with your brother. So Jesus takes the opportunity to dive into this one. And look at verse 15. Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed." So he's obviously seeing greed or a form of greed in this man's heart. And Jesus is concerned about that greed. He uses really strong language there. Watch out. This is a very serious problem. Beware. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Greed for money. Greed for status. Often those two things kind of are connected, particularly in the ancient world. Greed is a destructive thing for you. Greed is a destructive thing for those around you because fundamentally you're getting stuff for yourself at the expense of people around you. And so Jesus spots that in this guy's heart and sees that that's really where this question's coming from. This is where the dispute's coming from. He's wanting it for himself. And so Jesus goes, "You be very careful of greed. It's incredibly destructive." And I don't think any of us would disagree with that, would we? Society in general tends to see greed as a bad thing. But then Jesus goes on and makes an even bigger claim. Look at what he says there. And this is like a statement for life, really a big sweeping statement about what life is about or particularly what life's not about. "A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." A man or woman's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. In other words, simple English, life is not about how much stuff you own. And again, most people would nod their heads to that, yeah? Most people would go, yeah, of course. Most people around society would go, of course, yeah, of course. It's not about just owning more stuff. But Jesus spots this in the man in front of him. He spots this in his heart, and he can see at the very core that this man is going after life in money and in things. And Jesus spots it in his heart. Jesus spots it in your heart and in my heart when we go looking for life, contentment, satisfaction, happiness, when we go looking for life in stuff. And he spots it. Can you spot it? Can you spot it in your own heart, in your own life? Because while everybody agrees that this is not what life's about, life's not about possessions, usually people step on and then say, well, no, life's about relationships and family and doing good things and leaving the world a better place. And if we all get that, why is it that we still find ourselves running after possessions as though that is where life is found? See if you can catch yourself running after possessions to seek life in them. Because chances are you'll be able to catch yourself at some level thinking, if only I could get this next car or this next house or that renovation or that holiday or this. If only I could get that thing, then I'll be able to just kind of go, oh, yeah. Then I'll be able to experience life. There's something in us that goes after things continually. The thing you wake up in the morning thinking about, the thing you daydream about as you go on, the thing you work hard for, the things you spend your money on, that is, chances are, that's where you're seeking life. And it's very easy to seek life in possessions, even though we know it's silly. Now, some of you might say, oh, look, I don't run after possessions. But you might kind of fast walk after possessions. You know what I mean by fast walk? You try and pretend you're not running because you're trying to pretend life's bigger than, more than possessions, but you're just doing that weird Olympic walking thing where they're kind of running as far as they're just, you know, just. You want me to do it? No, you don't, all right? It's that weird elastic thing with your legs. The point is this. We can even try and pretend that we don't go after life in possessions, but catch yourself, because we do. And often our behaviour, when you examine your behaviour, that will actually expose what you really believe. And you might catch yourself believing that really you're going after life in things. And Jesus says very clearly here, life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. Believe it. Live it. And to help us get it, he tells a story. Pick up the story there with me, the parable. You see it in verse 16. And he told them this parable. It's a pretty simple parable. There's a rich man getting richer. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Picture's pretty simple. There's a guy with a lot of wealth. And back in agricultural times, your wealth would be basically shown by how many barns you had and how full of produce and crops they were. He already had a number of barns and they're chockers full of crops and produce from previous crops, previous seasons. He's wealthy, 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 but he's got a problem. He's got more wealth coming at him and he doesn't know what to do with it. He's got more crop coming in, a bumper crop coming in. He doesn't know where to put it and he doesn't consider kind of just sharing it around and giving out to his neighbours and helping his community. He's thinking, no, what am I going to do? That's his problem. And so he makes a decision what to do with this more wealth coming towards him. Look at verse 18. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, a little bit of self-talk here. Here's what he's saying to himself. You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Now, at some level, any financial advisor that you go and sit with would kind of say, good call. Wise, smart living. What do you do when wealth is coming your way? Well, you work hard to secure that wealth and make it work harder so you get more in the future. And that's what this guy does. He works hard. He worked hard to demolish his existing barns and have to build new ones, bigger ones, to store all his wealth. And if you kind of stop there, I reckon a lot of people, perhaps even you would read that and go, that's wise. And Jesus says, nah, foolish to the extreme. And we've got to figure out why. Why is that so foolish? I mean, look at verse 20. Jesus doesn't mix his words, but God said to him, you fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? So here's the first reason why the guy's being foolish. Because he's going to die tonight and he's not even going to make it to the years where he gets to experience his retirement, the very moment that he's been working hard toward, saving everything for. God says to him, you're going to die tonight. You're not even going to make it, mate. You're not even going to experience all that enjoyment. You are living for a moment that's not going to come. It's foolish. And really what's embedded in that comment is this. None of us control the moment when we go. We'd love to think we can. We live as though we can. We all live as though it's all going to come for us and we're going to have that retirement and we're all going to live to 80 or 90, but it's not going to be the case for some of us, perhaps many of us. Have you considered you might not make it to your retirement? Again, it doesn't mean don't put in place a retirement plan, but to live as though it's definitely coming is ultimately foolish. Because you're working hard your whole life towards a moment that may not come. And Jesus is just saying, just on a base level, foolish to throw all your eggs in one basket, and you might not even need to get to, you might not even get a chance to sit in that basket and eat your eggs. I just made that one up, all right? That's not good financial advice, really, is it? Don't make the same mistake this guy does. Do not spend all of your focus, all of your time, all of your money, all of your energy working toward that one moment when you think you will really live. Because that moment might not come. And live with that in mind. But it's foolish for another reason, a greater reason. And it's explained in verse 21. You see, it's not foolish to simply have a retirement plan. Have a look at this, verse 21. This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. That, my friends, I suggest is the key to understanding what's going on here. To store up things for yourself without being rich towards God is the ultimate foolish thing to do with your life. There's a level to which it's entirely appropriate to provide for yourself and even save up. But to do that without being rich toward God is the dumbest thing you can ever do with your life. So what does it mean to be rich toward God? That's what we're going to knuckle into. Are you being rich toward God with your life right now? Because if you're not, you need to. Otherwise, you're going to be called a fool by God himself. Are you rich toward God in your life right now? I think it's a beautiful way of describing what we're attempting to do as Christians together. We're trying to be rich toward God every day. And you can imagine that's a broad thing, isn't it? But let's try and see what evidences we have in the passage of what it means to be rich towards God. Here's the first thing. It encompasses all of life, but I kind of want to start on the more obvious one, which is basically what you do with your moolah. Yeah? To be rich towards God has at least got to mean this, hasn't it? That you spend your money generously on the things that God is concerned about. The things that God is concerned about. Now, we all know how to spend our money generously because you do it easily. You spend your money generously, easily on the things that you are concerned about. No one needs to tell you to spend money on things you're already concerned about. The question is, are you spending your money generously on the things that God is concerned about? In other words, are the things you're concerned about the same things God is concerned about? Because I actually trust that that is what will happen for us as we grow up in our faith and as we mature in our Christianity. The things we're concerned about become more and more the things God is concerned about, and we spend our life, our attention, our money, at least, on those things. So what are those things? What are the things that God is concerned about? Well, it needs to be said, God is concerned that you provide for yourself and your family. Yep, he is. That's part of what he's concerned about. He's concerned about community issues, broadly. He's concerned for justice in our land. He is concerned for the poor and the needy among us, that we would help them. In fact, he goes so far as to say, later on in the passage, sell your possessions and give your money to the poor. Jesus is very concerned for the poor, which primarily does talk about financial poverty. But you see in Luke's gospel, it's the concept of someone being poor is broader than just finances. Really, the poor person in the gospel of Luke that Jesus is concerned for is the one who's poor in spirit. When Jesus says, I've come for the poor, he's saying, I've come for those who know they're poor, can acknowledge their neediness in material ways, and can therefore more easily acknowledge their neediness in spiritual ways. And they know they've got sin that needs to be dealt with. They know they need rescuing. They know they need help. Jesus says, I've come for you, those who know you need help, which I think directs us toward what God is ultimately concerned about. I've talked about broadly what he's concerned about, but can I suggest what God is ultimately concerned about can be seen pretty clearly in the ministry of Jesus and his focus. Jesus did heal. Jesus did look out, care for the poor. He did many things in his ministry, but all of his ministry focused on one moment, the moment where he goes to the cross, to take your sin and my sin so that we might live for eternity. That is the focus of Jesus' ministry because it is God's primary concern that sinners have their sin dealt with. God's ultimate concern is this, that people would be saved from their sin, that people like you and I would be rescued from hell. Jesus says clearly, I have come to seek and to save the lost. That's the guts of it. That's what I'm primarily concerned about. God is primarily concerned about making a way for people to enter his kingdom and belong to his people and belong to his church. That is, can I suggest, God's ultimate concern. So here's the question we need to ask. Are you and I being richly generous towards God's ultimate concern? Mission. Seeing people saved here on the Central Coast and globally. If that's God's number one concern, my question is, am I being richly generous towards that one? And that's for us to consider. That's at least the first one for us to consider. Or when you look into your life and what you do with your finances, do you spot evidences that you're not being primarily concerned and generous towards God's big concern? Is it that you might observe that you're giving scraps or the leftovers to the thing that God is ultimately concerned about? Now, I have to say, continually actually encouraged as I see how believers in this church give generously. Last year alone, over $500,000 was given to mission beyond us globally. Now, that's encouraging. That's awesome. And what's just happened recently, as we've done everything we can to try and get this next bigger rain shelter up so we can reach more people for Christ, that blows me away, the generosity that people are giving their finances towards the things that are actually likely to see people saved. It says a lot. But just think about yourself for a moment. Maybe you're in that category of being really working hard and giving generously lately. Maybe you might identify that you're not giving generously towards the things that are of ultimate concern to God. Can I just go on a little rant for a moment? Can you forgive me as I go on a rant? I've been in full-time pastoral ministry for now for close to 20 years. And I don't say that to blow my own horn, just say that to kind of say, sometimes I get a B in my bonnet about some things. Can I give you a B that's in my bonnet? Sometimes people come to the pastors of churches and they say, hey, I've got this thing. Does the church need it? But it's usually something like this. I've got this old telly. I've got this old couch. Does the church need it? Does the youth need it? And on some level, that's totally appropriate. And we need heaps of couches because they get trashed in about a week and then we've got to chuck them out of the youth hall. So we need that kind of thing. But occasionally I've kind of had the courage to kind of say to people, oh, what's wrong with it? Oh, nothing. Perfect working order. It's great. Oh, so why are you getting rid of it? Oh, I've got a new one. To which I say, oh, the new one would be good, thanks. Now you might think, oh, what do we do? You know, why do we do that? Why do we sometimes go out and buy new things to replace old things that are still working? Why do we think first to do that for ourselves? And then almost as an afterthought kind of go, what can I do with this? I could chuck it out the front of my lawn. Oh, maybe the church needs it. Go and ask the church. Now, it's a bee in my bonnet. I'm kind of having a bit of a crack. But like, is giving towards God and his things an afterthought for you? Or is it in the primary part of your focus, the first things you think about, the first fruits that God's enabled you to work? He's entrusted you with everything you've got for a season so that you would be about his things. Catch yourself giving God the scraps. Be rebuked. I'm rebuked. Be richly generous towards the things God is primarily concerned about. God's worth it. He's worth it. Now, some of you, as I'm kind of sharing these things, are thinking, yeah, but I am actually worried. That's what stops me. I'm literally worried that if I do, I don't have enough. And for some of you, that's a very real worry, and I don't want to pretend that that's not the case, because we all go through times where we battle financially. If some of you are thinking, I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to get by. Well, Jesus knows you're worried. He addresses your worry because he's anticipating you're going to be worried about doing this. Have a look. Verse 22. Then Jesus said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, about your body or what you'll wear. Life is more than food and the body is more than clothes. Jesus' point is here is this. Don't worry. Get a bigger vision of life. There's more to life than stuff. And then he goes on and he says, I know your needs and I can look after you. He goes on, look, consider the ravens, the rats of the air. That's what a raven is. Rats with wings. They're the most feral beasts, apparently, in this day. So consider even the ravens. They don't sow or reap, yet they have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them. How much more valuable are you than birds? The point is this, God's saying, I know you, I care about you, I can look after you. Don't stress. Don't worry. In fact, he goes on to say, it's actually pointless to worry. Because as you worry, is that helping? Does it actually give you any more days? He says, no, you can't even add one day to your life by worrying. So it's pointless. So don't worry. Now, when he says don't worry, sometimes that can be a frustrating thing to hear, can't it? Is Jesus saying here that I'm just not even allowed to think about the things that I need for my daily living? No. It's okay to make a legitimate effort to provide for yourself and your family. When he says worry here, he's talking about something very particular, and you pick it up in verse 29. Look at this. This is the worry that he's talking about. He says, do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it. So the kind of worry that he's talking about here is when you set your heart on what you'll eat or drink or wear or live in or the possess. What does it mean to set your heart on something? It means to focus on it, seek after it, form an attachment to it as though life depended on it. And Jesus goes, no, don't do that. Look after things, but do not live like that, because if you live like that without trust and dependence on God, you're just running after what the pagans run after. That's what he says there. You're living just like the pagans, which is just say you're living like those who actually don't acknowledge God, who look for life in possessions. Well, what else are they going to look for life in? Christian, don't look for life in those things. Don't put your trust in those things. Put your trust in God. To worry is to fear. You pick that up later on. Fear, I'm not going to have enough. And fear drives a lot of what we do. And he presses on to basically say, it's not about not worrying at all in life and just turn into this person that just floats around. God, just everything's wonderful. Jesus said, no, don't worry about that stuff. But I tell you what you ought to be worried about. Worry about this. Worry about something worthwhile. Seek after this. Go after this. And look at the language there in verse 31. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Seek his kingdom. Worry about that. Go after that. Give yourself to that. Live richly towards God for the sake of his kingdom. Now, we looked at kingdom a few weeks ago. The concept of kingdom is the fact that Jesus is king and we are to live in submission to him. So if we're not seeking after possessions, we need to be seeking after his kingdom. To be rich towards God is to seek his kingdom. Set your heart on it. Go after it like life depends on it, because it actually does. Life depends on being in his kingdom. And life for others depends on them coming into his kingdom. So I've got three things to do with kingdom, seeking his kingdom. The first one's this, to live well as a subject in his kingdom. Kingdom concepts are a little foreign to us these days. But to be part of God's kingdom is to acknowledge that he's the sovereign Lord over all things and you are a subject. He is the one who will provide for you, protect you, and you are to live in submission to him, happy, humbly submitting to him in your conduct and in your attitude, honouring the king. That's how to seek the kingdom. It starts with you and the way you live, that you would live as a subject, happily, humbly, before your king. Secondly, it means that you will pray, your kingdom come. We looked at the Lord's Prayer a couple of weeks ago. To pray, your kingdom come, is fundamentally to pray, God, would you cause there to be more who come and bow the knee before you as king? Would you hallow your name in that? Would you cause your name to be lifted up? And would you take honour for it? And would you sweep me up into that? So pray that God's kingdom would come and get about his work. Get about giving yourself to seeing people come into his kingdom and bow the knee before him. The third thing you want to acknowledge is this. In seeking his kingdom, you just want to settle in your heart that it's going to be costly. If you try to run after Jesus but minimize the cost continually, it's just not going to work. You're going to slow down your run and you're never going to be happy about the cost. But the minute we can acknowledge in our hearts that to actually go after God, to actually live richly towards him, to actually seek his kingdom, to actually focus on the things he's concerned about, it's going to be costly. Can you welcome the cost? I mean, look at the cost in verse 32. Here's where we read radical things and we kind of go, oh, I don't know what that's all about. We'll just move on to the next verse. Look at verse 32. Don't be afraid, little frock. Oh, frock. Come on. Hey. Don't be afraid, little flock. For your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. It's intimate language there, acknowledging our fear to live like this. And he said, don't be afraid. I've given you everything. You don't need to go out. You don't need to be afraid you're not going to get the possessions. Don't find security in them. I've given you my kingdom. I've brought you into my kingdom. You have security in me. Look at verse 33. Live like this. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Righto. So who's selling their possessions and giving to the poor? Because I don't want to just skirt over it and kind of go, yeah, that might mean something like this. I'll tell you what it actually means. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Like, when was the last time you sold something and gave the money away? I'm not talking that Gumtree ad, you know, where the wife gets all the bloke's stuff and he sells it, but then he's ended with a bag of cash to spend on himself. No. Sell your stuff, get your bag of cash and give it away to someone who needs it more than you. When was the last time you did that? Some of you may have done it recently, and if you have, you know it's an incredibly freeing thing to do. And so sometimes you get a glimpse of that when you're getting rid of stuff, all the stuff. You might move house or something, and you're forced to kind of get rid of stuff and cull things back. And more often than not, here's what I hear people say, oh, it's just wonderful to kind of live more simply and kind of get rid of all these things. There's something about possessions which just sit over the top of you and burden you and crush you. We go after them as though they're going to give us life, but they hold us bondage. And to actually get rid of them, at least some of them, can be an incredibly freeing thing to do. If you've never got rid of stuff before, even just for the sake of doing it, go sell some stuff and give the money away. Don't use it to spend on someone else's stuff they're selling. Get rid of some stuff. Now, as Jesus kind of comes out with a cracker like this, is he suggesting that Christians should never own anything? Is Jesus against private ownership of possessions? Does he just want us to be these holy paupers that live on the street? No. Number one, to sell everything you've got means you end up going to be a burden on those around you. It's not loving to be a burden on those around you deliberately. Number two, Jesus never directly rebukes anyone for simply owning stuff. Jesus and his disciples are continually on the receiving end of hospitality from people who own houses. Jesus himself, as he's hanging on the cross, says to John, who must have had a house, he says, can you look after my mum? Can you take her into your house? So the disciples obviously still had stuff. So why does Jesus say, sell possessions, give to the poor? It's because he understands this. He understands the power of possessions and the danger of owning possessions. And the emphasis is this. If you're going to be a believer, you must not be dominated by your possessions, because they easily dominate you. It easily happens that we end up trusting in them, relying on them, finding security in them, and that is a fatal barrier for life, because it inhibits you trusting in, God, the only trustworthy one. So be very careful of possessions. Just know they're dangerous. Be careful about accumulating too many of them. Get rid of them sometimes. Seek his kingdom. It's going to be costly. I'm going to kind of wrap up by talking about two things just now. Because if you're new to these things, or even if you're not, you may be sitting here thinking, this sounds like a really hard way to live. To be rich towards God, to seek his kingdom. I just don't know if I've got it in me to kind of live that kind of a life. This is a hard and costly way to live. Why should I live this way? Why should I be rich towards God? I've got two things for you. Number one, he is completely deserving of all of the riches you can chuck his way. Number two, live this way and you'll be actually working for real riches. Let me unpack those two things. God does not call us to be rich towards him because he's in need of our generosity in any way. You want to acknowledge that. God is not in need of our help. His wealth is beyond comprehension. His wealth in his own glory and in his own majesty is so vast, we'll never get our heads around it. We'll see it one day. We only get glimpses of it now. From his own wealth and majesty, he actually created all things that exist. So in effect, he still owns them. All things, every piece of land, every cow. There's a classic psalm where the psalmist sings out and says that God owns every cow on the hill. And it's true. You know, we divide up our little blocks and we put our names on them and we have our things and we're like, mine, mine, mine. And God's like, mine. It's all mine. Like if you've got something, it's because I've entrusted it to you for a season, for a purpose. But it's actually mine. I'm the one who, out of my incredible richness, has been generous to you, fundamentally generous, by pouring out mercy and grace with Jesus on the cross. There is God's ultimate act of generosity towards us. We get that in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9, where we see that the grace of our Lord Jesus is this, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you in his poverty might become rich. God pours out his riches on us in all of life, but ultimately in Jesus. He is therefore completely deserving of any piece of richness that you can offer to him. You will never offer him more than he is worth. Your time, your energy, your finances, you will never be able to be rich enough towards him. You'll never be able to be too rich towards him. He's utterly deserving. Here's the second one. Be rich towards God. Live to seek his kingdom, knowing that as you do, you're actually working towards the ultimate retirement plan. You're actually working for real riches, permanent riches, riches and wealth that will actually never be taken away from you. Riches and wealth that you'll never need to leave behind. Riches and wealth which will never deteriorate. Pick it up there in verse 33. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Provide purses for yourself that will not wear out. A treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted. Where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Living richly toward God now actually stores up treasure in heaven for you. Now, we don't get a lot of detail on exactly what that treasure looks like, so we find ourselves speculating a little. And I think some good ideas have been come up with. You could probably come up with some good ideas as well. Whatever it is, the riches that we will be given in glory will cause anything that you consider to be nice here just pale into insignificance. All the things we go after here, we'll look back at them and go, well, there's nothing. The joy I got in that possession was nothing compared to the joy I have now in these things. And you know, I can't help but to say that these things must fundamentally be God himself that we get, because it's God himself that will never be taken away from us. It's God himself that will never decrease in value. It's God himself which will only increase in richness. And so live for the ultimate retirement plan. Be rich toward God now. Seek his kingdom now. Store up treasures for yourself there. An eternal wealth, an ultimate retirement plan, a real one. Don't get stuck on stuff here. I'll finish with a story. Got to go to Disneyland last year. That's pretty exciting. Always wanted to go to Disneyland. Mum and Dad never took me to Disneyland when I was a kid, so I had to take myself as a 38-year-old or something. Still in my 30s, by the way. Some of you think, oh, that's really old, and others you're like, wow, 30s. Anyway, Disneyland. And I'm standing there with me mate, right, and we're about to go in, and I just noticed this thing out of the corner of my eye, which was kind of funny and stuck with me. There's a fountain outside of Disneyland. It's kind of a nice-looking fountain. It's kind of pretty. And it's just before you kind of go into the real deal. And there was this kid kind of stuck, standing, looking at the fountain, like, wow, just kind of just blown away by it. And his parents are lining up, and they're like, come on, we're going in, we're going in. He's just there going, fountain, fountain. And I just walked past going, well, that's kind of funny. You know, to kind of get stuck on the fountain and not get into Disneyland where it's just, that's where it's happening. You know, it's kind of, wouldn't it be tragic if the kid never went in and he was stuck there forever? I'll tell you a far worse tragedy. To be stuck on stuff here and never get to go in and experience the glory and the joy that you were created for. Let me pray. Father God, you have been so incredibly generous towards us, giving us life, giving us what we need for every day, but ultimately pouring out your generosity to us and your richness to us in Christ. You call us to come after you and live richly towards you and seek your kingdom, and we see that that is costly. But in comparison to what you have done for us, Lord, we see that you are utterly deserving of an entire lifetime of devotion, pouring ourselves out for you. Father, would you enable us by your Spirit to live this way with our eyes fixed on the real life beyond this one, in your presence, knowing true joy and satisfaction like we only see glimpses of here. Lord, would you cause us to pay the cost now for that moment? Amen.